Today is July 7th, 2016, and I am sitting here with Austin DeLone. Thank you, Austin,
for coming
to sit down. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am interviewing you on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library.
Fantastic.
I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to tell us your story, to share with us your experiences of living in the area and the amazing people you've met in the many years you've been here.
Great.
Okay, so Austin, may I call you Austin?
Please do.
Austin, how about a little contextual information? Where are you from? Where were you raised?
I was born and raised outside Philadelphia, born at the Bryn Mawr Hospital, and lived there until I went off to college. And then lived there no more.
So you went off to college where?
Harvard.
Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
So you're born what year?
I was born in 1946.
46.
Which is the same year that the house I live in now, in Sycamore Park area, was built.
Wow.
There's something of no particular note.
Well, I know. I just talked to Sammy Hagar, and he said El Paseo was built the year he was born.
Right.
So maybe it's something you musicians work out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, so you were born in 1946 mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, and you went to Harvard.
Yeah.
And studied what?
English. I was thinking about being a poet, and I suppose I ended up in somewhat the same direction as I ended up being a musician and a songwriter.
Hmm. And so did you graduate from Harvard?
Or? I did not graduate from Harvard. I dropped out to come out to California.
So.
And to be with a friend of mine who we had written a few songs while I was still in college, and he was freelancing around the country. One of the songs was called One for One. It was the very first song that Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies put out as a single.
How's it go?
Oh,
you can sing it back.
It's a mildly mediocre song, and it goes like this. If I hadn't grown with you, and if half my life had been spent. I don't think it's a great song. It's not top of my list, but it was put out as a single and had a little cello on it, Linda Ronstadt singing a fantastic voice of hers,
uh-huh.
and it went approximately nowhere. But the second single that they put out was called Different Drummer, which was a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were, when did you start playing music?
When did I start?
Yes.
I first started playing music when I was 12 years old. And I took some piano lessons in the spring and part of the summer. And then in the fall, I just was more interested in playing football, so I didn't do as many lessons then. With a lovely teacher named Mrs. Housen, I thought she was totally cool. She used to smoke Camel cigarettes, non-filters, of course. I don't even know if they had filters at that point. But and one would be dangling from her mouth as she showed me these great things on the piano. I thought she was like the coolest. She was really a great woman. And she greatly encouraged my musicality and my ear. She was not a strict disciplinarian. I did a little bit of that later on when I dropped out of college.
Mm-hmm. So she just took a look at you and tried to figure out who you were and encouraged that, eh?
Yeah, she said, I had a good ear, so if she would show me the work that I wanted to do, she would play it once. I would pretty much calculate it, so I knew when I went home to practice that I could get it. So, and I really was really into some sort of early jazz stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you're playing piano. What other musical instruments do you play?
When I was about 16, I picked up a guitar, I think. What was it? My brother's guitar. And the first thing I did was just put my fingers on it, and I played a G chord. I thought, well, this is going to be easy. And so I played the guitar from then. I picked up a sax once and played two or three correct notes, but that was as far as I got on the saxophone. So I play keyboards of all kinds, especially piano and Hammond B3 organ. Those are the ones I really like, and a Wurlitzer electric piano. And also I play guitar, electric guitar, acoustic guitar. I can play a bit of bass. And I can stumble through on drums, but you probably don't want to hire me for that.
So you were in Harvard. Your friend introduced you to, a free and easy minstrel life, I suppose. And you the wind blew you away and into other places.
Yeah, it actually dropped. I dropped out of Harvard once when I was having some trouble, and took a year off, went back, and was having no trouble, and I was just sailing through and getting straight A's. I'm not sure why, but mm-hmm. apparently I was smart for that 6 months or so. And then at the end of it, I just said, oh, this is not what I want to do. And that's when I left.
And so when you turned away from Harvard, where'd you turn to?
California.
So you headed west.
Yeah. I headed west and joined up with my friend that I'd written the song with, and we started playing music and had some band stuff, and then I played with a bunch of other people around, and soon met a friend of mine named Jack O'Hara, who the both of us then moved back to the East Coast, to New York City, and met our third partner named Brian Hopkins and started a band called Eggs Over Easy. That was our, that we were in for from 69 until 80 or 81. And when I moved to Mill Valley, that was with that band, Eggs Over Easy.
So
the
you were,
Eggs.
I have to ask the name. Why Eggs Over Easy?
Well, I could say why not, but basically it was after a show in New York City. We were late night and into a little breakfast joint, you know, 2 a.m. in the morning. And our buddy Brian looked up at the menu and said, "That's it, Eggs Over Easy." And we decided to go with it. We had some other names we were tossing around, but for some reason we picked that name.
Huh.
Maybe not the best name ever, but probably not the worst.
Yeah. Yes, I've heard some really bad names. It's not the worst. So now you've gone from New York over here. You're performing. And anywhere else? Did you stay in this country? Did you move around?
When we first moved from basically Berkeley and then Oakland back to New York and met our buddy Brian, we then went to England to record with a guy named Chaz Chandler, who was the bass player from the Animals and also the producer and manager for Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd signed on with a film company called Canon Films, and they had just started their music department with a guy named Peter Kauf, who had been an agent for, well, the Beatles and the Animals, and was good friends with Chaz. So we'd looked at a few producers, and then Chaz said, "Why don't you guys come to England and record with me?" We went, Jimi Hendrix, England, Chaz, Eggs Over Easy, no problem.
Well, the Animals were there, Eric Burdon and the Animals.
The Animals were fantastic. Yeah. Chaz was a great guy, a great bass player. So anyway, we went over and recorded with him, and for various reasons, we're not able to put out the album at the time. We left Canon Films on the advice of our manager, and then we stayed in England for a year and just started playing around, and we ended up being credited with starting a British movement called Pub Rock.
Pub Rock.
Pub Rock, which led to of the most famous were Brinsley Schwartz. Ace had a big hit called How Long Has This Been Going On?
Oh, how long
has this been going on? You take the upper part, I'll take the lower. and then that whole scene, which really popped up pretty much after we left, we started it in one pub, and then there grew to be.
What do you mean, British pub scene? So
it's called Pub Rock.
Or Pub Rock.
Pub Rock.
So give me the idea. Walk in there, it's Pub Rock night. What is that?
Well, you know, it would be over here, you might call it a bar band thing. The thing that was happening in British music back then was the big glam stuff, Dave Bowie, Yes, whatever, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the sort of heavy, big thing. And all we were doing was we just wanted to play music. You know, we were hoping to get a contract and all that stuff, but we just wanted to go play. So we went up to a pub and started with one night of music. It was actually a jazz pub at the time. They had six nights of jazz, and Jack went up there and said, can we play? And I said, well, we've got a Monday night open. So we played Monday for beer, and then they started paying us, and a few people came and heard us the first night, and next time we played, a few more people came, and next thing you know, it morphed into a big scene. So the thing that was good about pub rock, and they say, which sort of eventually led to punk rock, and in all these pubs that burst out, mostly around London, I think, The thing that was good was it was just a place where people could go play and try to write their own songs. There were no big pretensions, and there was no concern about, have you got enough money coming in the door, and is this going to, are your records going to sell at all? It was sort of anti-hype in that sense. So it was just a cool place to go and express yourself and to have a good time.
So you could be about the music rather than the just the creating of the band and the promotion and all
right.
that.
Exactly.
It was being a musician, doing what you want to do without needing the approval
yeah.
of a recording company
yeah.
or anything.
So that's, sort of led to some of the independent stuff and the punk and new wave stuff, because that was, again, was just more people going, getting, obviously, the punk stuff. Our stuff was quite sort of musical, like the Loving Spoonful and the band, a little bit of country, just a kind of nice mix of blends, lots of great vocals.
Did you
and
have a
so
particular
we weren't, we
song?
We didn't have a punk sound.
Did you have a song that was, when you think, a kind of an iconic song for that you guys created at that time? One of your favorites?
Oh, yeah, we had a few. We had I'm Funky But I'm Clean. I'm Funky But I'm Clean. Do You Know What I Mean? And people would love to sing along. We did a funny song that we never actually did record called The Siege of Leningrad, which was a silly thing that started slow and ended up going very fast in a faux Russian groove. I don't know. We had a bunch of songs.
And it sounds like you had some fun.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. We did mostly original songs, but we do play anybody's covers that we wanted to. We lived together. We all lived together at this time. And when we first came to Mooali, we lived together for a year or two as well.
I have to ask you this. When I'm imagining this, pump or this rock pub scene, what were you wearing? What was the garb?
Jeans and a shirt,
Really, jeans and a shirt.
Yeah.
No skin tight striped pants, nothing like that.
No skin tights. And I don't think we probably didn't have bell bottoms yet. We were probably just wearing normal jeans or corduroys and, a shirt of some sort.
How about
maybe
your hair?
Hair was longish, definitely.
Good.
And our drummer for the whole year that we were there, just for what it's worth, was a guy named John Steele, who was the drummer from the Animals. A terrific guy and a great drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Great, great band. Okay, so you were doing the pub scene, and that was great, but then you ended up coming back to America.
Came back to America, went to New York where our manager was, and worked on getting a contract, got a contract with A&M Records, and went to Tucson to record with Link Wray, who was a great guitar god of the 50s and 60s. Had a hit called Rumble that was one of the very, very first early big guitar instrumentals. Dum, dum, dum. Dum, dum, dum. Anyway, Link was at least part Native American and fantastic guy. So we recorded at his brother's studio in Tucson, Arizona, and then moved out to L.A. to A&M Records to finish up the mixes there. And after we were done with that, we the chap who was our road manager, Sidney Hungen, said, my brother lives up in a town called Mill Valley. Let's go up there and just kick back for a minute and see what we're going to do next. So we moved to Mill Valley. We came up to Mill Valley and I saw some of our friends who also lived here that we had known in Berkeley. We came to Mill Valley in May of 72, and here I am, still here.
What was your first impression of Mill Valley when you came?
Ah, great, beautiful. Well, we loved it. We started hanging out with some of our friends and also hanging out at a place called the Old Mill Tavern, right in the center of town, which is now, of course, Vasco's Restaurant, and has gone through quite a few changes since it was the Old Mill.
Was it O'Leary's too?
It was O'Leary's. It went from being the Old Mill to different owners at the Old Mill, then to O'Leary's. Then it was it the Frog and Peach or something like that?
The Peach
Annabelle's,
and the Frog. Yeah.
In maybe something else, and now it's that lovely Vasco's restaurant, which is great. So it's funny, when I walk into Vasco's, I can look around, and although it doesn't look exactly the same, I can sort of see, ooh, I remember when that happened over there. Ooh, better not look at that. And
all these various happened?
I can't, not on the interview.
That was the 70s.
It was a wild time in there, and it was quite an amazing joint. And the thing that really struck us about the old mill and the town at that time was, it was such an incredible mix of really different kinds of people. I mean, there were sort of leftover rednecks and guys who would, when the old mill, you know, in the 60s apparently had been, well, there were about 5 bars in town at that time. There was the Office, which later morphed into the Sweetwater. There was Quinn's, which is now Mill Valley Market's deli and liquor department. There was the Brothers, which is now the Bead Store.
Mm-hmm. Over down on Miller, off of Miller.
Yeah, on Locust, right by, across from the 7-Eleven. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the 2 a.m. Club, the Deuce, the Mighty Deuce, which is still there today. It was just a fantastic mix of, as I say, like rednecks, construction workers, gay people, insurance people, doctors, and some musicians such as the Eggs. And it was just a wild mix, and everybody pretty much got along. There would still be some, every now and then, big old fights would break out.
Where? At the old mill?
Oh, yeah.
You had brawls at the old mill?
Huh?
You had brawls at the old mill?
Oh, yeah. Hell, yeah. Because as I said before, you know, in the 60s, somebody told me, yeah, oh, this used to be like Saturday night fights. All the friends would come down, they'd get drunk, and then they'd just start fighting with each other.
Well, like what might precipitate such a brawl?
Oh, just an argument. Somebody bumping into somebody on a bar stool. You know, anything that touched off. There were a lot of brawls in a lot of the places that we played back then, in the various places around the county. And, you know, and bars, it was more common. You don't see it very much nowadays. But even in the later days in the Sweetwater, somebody would just, too much alcohol.
Uh-huh.
That always helps.
Uh-huh.
That always lifts it up into a brawl status. And, you know, and just somebody rubs somebody the wrong way, and then it just escalates. And
so
there you go.
As a musician, is it your policy to play through the brawl, or how do you usually?
Very good question. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, you kind of play through the brawl, but turn the music down. Don't stop. That just brings too much attention to it. And don't keep playing a loud, energetic song. So you've got to.
So you
back off.
It's like corralling the brawl subtly with your music.
Trying to calm it down. Yeah, that's the idea.
That's interesting. Is that just like generally understood with most?
I think it's probably sort of an automatic reaction. You know, it's not usually not a fight or flight situation that you have to actually.
Well, because you're up on a stage. So,
well,
you're not on a stage.
But it can develop into that. I've never been involved in one of those.
Have you ever had people flying across the stage?
I've had people, sure. People at the old mill or Sweetwater sort of, but not flying across the stage in a rage, just more in a sort of extended dance, let's say. Anyway, so then we were hanging out there, and our record came out on A&M, and we went and did a tour, sort of disappeared from town for about 4 months mostly, and then we came back, and they said, what do you guys do? I mean, you're down here having a couple beers every day. And
who's they? Who said?
The people at the bar.
Uh-huh.
At the old mill tower.
Oh.
We said, we're musicians. They went, you're kidding. No, we come on, play. So we started playing some music down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up turning into a pretty wild and fun scene, and turned into a lot of music. There were a lot of groups playing there all the time.
Like, and names of groups?
Sugar Daddy.
Mm-hmm.
Contraband, various groups, local groups. I can't think of them all right now. I can almost think of a few. Sorry, they're not coming back.
They'll come after the interview.
That was, 40 years ago.
And so you're how old then? I'm trying to...
I'm in late 20s to 30.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Young musician.
Young, grooving, having fun. Yeah.
And this Prune Music sit down on Miller Avenue that time.
Prune
too.
Music was down on
Did
Locust
you
right
to
next to.
Did you used to go visit the Prune
Music
store?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I used to go. I bought several instruments from Prune Music, and later on the Eggs, the Lee Michaels, who was a great musician of his, in his own right, bought Prune Music and ended up putting a recording studio in the back, which is where we recorded our last. The last thing that we did as the Eggs or Reese was an album for Lee Michaels called Fear of Frying.
Oh, no.
Sorry, when you're named Eggs or Reese, these things just happen. And
did you collaborate with other local musicians as well? Because there were a lot of people here at that time.
Oh, yeah. I ended up playing with a bunch of different people, and Jack ended up playing with a bunch of different people. Brian more or less kept to himself, but he played with some people, but not as much in a gigging way. I played with tons of different people. Jesse Barish, Anna Rizzo, stuff like that, local stuff. And I started playing with my buddy Bill Kirchen in a band called the Moonlighters. They ended up, and then working also with the band that he'd started many years before, called Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Eggs were done, I ended up working with Cody and then on and working with a bunch of other people. I ended up working with the Fabulous Thunderbirds from Austin, Texas for a while.
Mm-hmm.
With the great Jimmy Vaughn, Kim Wilson in that band, fantastic band.
Jimmy Vaughn was the brother of
Stevie Ray Vaughan,
who's with Bruce Springsteen. Right?
No, Stevie Ray Vaughan was just his... thing was just his own thing, a Texas blues guy.
The bandana,
big hat, yeah. And concho belts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That also led to working with Elvis Costello, worked with Nick Lowe a bunch, who is a guy that I had met way back when the Eggs were in London in the early 70s.
Nick Lowe
is a guy who produced Elvis Costello's first few albums, but also wrote Peace, Love, and Understanding, and also is one of the supremely admired singer-songwriter guys of today and the whole. He's British, but I guess I don't know if you'd call him Americana, but he was a great, great performer, and he was in the band called Rockpile that was a monsterly great band along with Dave Edmunds. So worked with him, Paul Carrack, another fantastic British musician. Ended up doing some work with Bonnie Raitt, Boz Skaggs, and a bunch of Howard Tate and Carla Thomas, some of the great R&B soul singers from Memphis and Philadelphia. And I just ended up doing a lot of stuff. And then I ended up for about 12 years being the music director for something called the BAMMIES, which was the Bay Area Music Awards, which was a lovely celebration of bands and music from around the Bay Area that ended up kind of petering out in, I don't even remember when, maybe early 2000s, and just not, for some reason, losing its audience.
Although you had the wonderful award ceremonies and the events, and I remember the BAMMIES.
Oh, the BAMMIES was great. So it was everybody was in the BAMMIES, the Huey Lewis, Santana, John Fogerty, on and on and on, all the various bands, Four Non-Blondes, and all the various bands that were young bands that came up and had a couple hits and were stars there at that time, Counting Crows. The list is
pretty much,
and it was a big show. Usually, most of the years I did it was at the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall they were quite big events.
Yeah, it was really fun.
So you're the music director.
I was a music director.
What does a music director do? Select the
I
bands?
Don't know.
I always wondered about that.
I always wondered myself. Yeah. Well, you have to assemble all the various pieces of music, and basically we had a pit band that would, if you came up to win an award, we would play a little section of your song, mm-hmm. or if there was some kind of segue we had to make some music for, we'd also play music, usually to start off the show, and frequently to start off the second half, and a lot of times at the end of the show there would be something, sort of an organized not jam necessarily, but a song that you know, a bunch of different of the stars would get up and sing, and we'd be the band to back up that. So mm-hmm. fair amount of musical.
Yeah, that's a lot of organizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you really inculcated yourself into this community in a big way.
Apparently so.
There's brawls at the old mill. There's the Bammies.
And I played at the Sweetwater from the very beginning of the Sweetwater, and and the 142 Throckmorton, which is also another great musical place. I played at the Old Mill School when we were fairly early on, and it's just the Eggs Over Easy performed for the fifth, and it was pandemonium.
Oh,
the children went wild.
Do tell.
It was quite funny, and I often have met, although now they're probably older and moved on, but I would meet people in their 20s or, you know, who were working as a waiter. One guy was working as a waiter at El Paseo. He said, "I remember you when the Eggs came and played at the Old Mill School."
You know, I've watched you talk about all the various venues that you played, but I have to say you seem to have a certain amount of pride talking about playing at Old Mill School. Oh.
Well, it was just a funny, noticeable thing. It was a really hilarious little event. And as I said, the kids, it was kind of pandemonium. We did it wasn't a brawl, but it was kind of great. And we did have to calm down a little bit. And we did. And just later on, it came back.
First through fifth, right? Would you have a particular...
Oh, you know, that's a good question. They were awfully young. They were awfully young. It must have been an assembly. I don't really remember. It's just a funny thing that happened. You know, and we've played for the library before, uh-huh. benefit for them, and done a various things. I've also done an open mic thing at the Sweetwater for many moons, and that's a nice community thing, especially now, the new Sweetwater, which is, of course, different than the old Sweetwater was, but a great place in its own right. And now that it's got the restaurant and cafe, it means people under 21 can come and perform there at the open mic quite freely, and it's a great opportunity for some. It's a lot of great kids in the high school, little, you know, junior year bluegrass bands and whatever, and just talented singer-songwriters. Yeah, a lot of great musicians around, and it's a really nice thing to be able to do that too.
Well, I think the open mics are actually sort of underrated. Some of the best music I've ever heard in this town has been at open mic on the Sweetwater.
Yeah, there's some really talented folk.
Yeah, amazing. People that you would obscure coming up out of, you know, off the mountain, off the beach, onto the stage, and really rather mind-blowing performances. So, any special memories, let's say, of the old Sweetwater at some point? Is there any moment that stands out as for you when you look back?
The Sweetwater was always a great place, a unique place to play, because it was so small, such a great intimate location. And so it was always really fun to play there. It was... And Jeannie Patterson was the lovely Jeannie Patterson, was always downstairs, and she sort of ran the thing. She had this great setup downstairs where her office was, a little pool table next door. It was really comfortable and fun hanging out. The underneath scene was in many ways as fun as the scene upstairs. But the things that stand out most vividly for me were the fantastic parties that John Goddard used to throw. Featuring people that he just wanted to invite to come and perform on his stage. So, a fantastic bunch of performers. Ry Cooder was at one with his band. Elvis Costello came the year that I did a tour with him, and he came back, and Elvis and Nick and Jerry Garcia were there. Elvis and Jerry on the stage at the same time. Robert Cray, John Lee Hooker, the list goes on and on and on. And those were
Muddy
some of,
Waters. No. Who was the blues performer that B.B. King. Wasn't he a friend of John's?
Oh, B.B. King was a good friend of John's. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever, don't believe he ever played at the Sweetwater, though he probably set foot in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of John's biggest customers, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
He would come through with his bus and just load up.
Yeah,
and Elvis Costello was also, I know, a big, big customer of John's.
Did you used to hang out at the Village Music Store?
Of course, I was at the Village Music all the time, spending what little extra cash I had to get the latest and the greatest. And John was always a fantastic resource. Who did that funny song about the bullhorn and over there? And he says, oh, of course, that was blah, blah, blah. And he would be able to spiel it off. His knowledge was just great. And he was very helpful with me, a lot for the Bammies when I had to research certain musical things. And if he didn't know it right away, he would dig in and find out. And as just his collection of records, which is still my favorite form of music. I still like listening to vinyl best of all.
Mm-hmm.
Was fantastic.
So you bought a house here in Mill Valley.
Yeah.
And you've raised your children here?
Raised my children here. I've got a daughter, Caroline, who's 24, and also a lovely singer and songwriter in her own right. Fantastic voice. We just did a show at the Sweetwater last week.
How does that feel, watching your own child, you know, as a performer yourself, making the choice to be a musician, and then watching your child up on stage?
Fantastic. She really has such a lovely voice. She's quite good, and she writes good songs. She even writes better songs than me, which kind of makes me angry, but I'll get over it. So I'm thrilled to see her moving and doing this thing that she really, really likes.
Uh-huh.
And she has a younger brother who's 18 now, whose name is Richard, who's a lovely, sweet guy, but he has a terrible genetic disorder called Prader-Willi syndrome. And it's very tough for him, of course. He lives in a group home now. Very tough on the family, and very tough on Caroline growing up, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a just unusual situation, and presents some difficulties that are hard for ones to come over. My wife and I actually started a nonprofit named after our son called the Richard DeLone Special Housing Project,
mm-hmm.
and with the view of creating residential situations for people with that specific disorder, because it needs such specific care.
Mm-hmm.
You have to lock up food, and there's other complications with it, so it's not for the general public, because you can't generally lock up food from people. It's messing with their civil liberties. But mm-hmm. in this case, it's a medical.
Because it's part of the condition is that they have an inability to control their appetite.
Right, they cannot control it. So
mm-hmm.
you really have to control their eating, or they're in trouble,
mm-hmm.
big trouble.
Mm-hmm. Life-threatening.
Life-threatening trouble, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you've got your foundation.
So we have the foundation. We've been working for a while and raised some money and doing pretty well in that way, mostly through our friends in the music business. We've done concerts at the Great American Music Hall and Bimbo's and the chapel in the city with our friends Elvis Costello, Ry Cooter, Boz, Skaggs. And we've just done a couple this year and last year at the Sweetwater, smaller, sort of more high-ticket, big dinner, private invitation events. Last year with Elvin Bishop and the great Bonnie Raitt.
Mm-hmm.
And this year with our good friend and benefactor, Boz Skaggs. And so that's been great. And the Sweetwater has been fantastic to help us and give us a good deal on doing an event there. So...
Very fortunate to live in a town where there really is community support. You actually have the venue to do big things around here. It's a small town, but there's a lot of heart here, I think.
There's a lot of heart, and then we've done a bunch of things. And of course, the Throckmorton also does some wonderful things for the community just as a whole, all the great variety and all the acting stuff they do with kids and stuff, and also the benefits that they put on. We've done a couple of fantastic things there.
Well, I noticed that you're on the in the band for a benefit that's coming up on the 60th anniversary of the Mill Valley Art Festival.
Yeah, the Great Mill Valley Arts Festival.
So I'm actually involved in the gala affair.
Oh,
and
great!
I call this band the Musical Sons of Mill Valley because you and others locals will be performing.
Yeah.
And the benefits go towards the Mill Valley Art Festival.
Right, now, and I know Sammy Hagar has pitched in his great stuff on that with some extra VIP stuff.
And yes, with the El Paseo restaurant, offering
right.
a restaurant and some donations. And
the old El Paseo.
We've got Bill Champlin coming to
Fantastic.
Perform with you.
Yeah, great.
And I'm really excited to see that. Listening to your story, I have to say that... I'm touched by the world and the community that you live in and thrive in. You know, the support that you have. I mean, when you think about what it is to live here, how would you describe your experience as a community member?
Well, you know, as I'd say, part of what we live in this little neighborhood in Sycamore Park. It's just sweet. It's now become, you know, a fairly expensive neighborhood, but it started out as just sort of working class
mm-hmm.
homes, post-war bungalows, we would call them.
Mm-hmm.
And just the neighborhood that we live in has been so fantastic to us as we grew up, and lots of kids running around back and forth from house to house, and everybody was friendly. And when our son was born with this terrible disorder, they were quite fantastic and really helped us out in some pretty serious situations when he would sometimes run out of the house and we'd get a call from Valerie. Hey, Richie's down here at our house. Come and get him. So, and lots of other things. So, anyway, so and our neighbors would help. Valerie, by the way, is Valerie Gellner, now formerly Valerie Varney, whose family used to own Varney's Hardware, and which turned into, well, more recently was Tyler Florence's place, but down
mm-hmm.
the big downtown hardware, and so
mm-hmm.
and fantastic.
So Valerie is your wife?
No,
Valerie is your
Valerie
neighbor.
Is just a neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
She was just an example of somebody who would,
mm-hmm.
and everybody on the street was really really helpful with Richie when he would get in, looked like he might get into trouble, and would, and also they were just terribly sweet with him. All the kids were really good with him, and it's a great lesson that a lot of kids are learning nowadays, that the disabled people who are disabled are much more accepted, and kids in school are totally accepting. It's like no big deal,
mm-hmm.
no big deal about that stuff anymore. It's just like the same thing with gays and stuff like that, you know. For this generation, it's like, no, what's the problem? There is no problem, because they're just people.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, I think, is very true for kids. You know, will sometimes look at Richie and stare a little bit, but it's not the fear factor that used to be around when you know, in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up and people were getting better. But it's all just slowly moving, getting better. No, my wife is Leslie DeLone,
mm-hmm.
the lovely Leslie from London.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you met your bride in London.
No, I met my bride in a small town called Mill Valley.
Oh, my.
Yeah,
huh.
Many years ago.
Huh. So, yeah. Do you see Mill Valley changed much?
Yeah, I'd say Mill Valley has changed. The personnel has changed. It's sort of less of... a little bit less of the working class community, but there's still a lot of community organization and a lot of community feel. You can sense it a lot just around the Sweetwater and the people that, you know, so many people have contributed to creating that fantastic thing. I mean, despite you know, besides, of course, Michael Klein's been great, and a lot of the investors, there's so many investors that are generous, and they really care about the place and come out for it. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And so that's really great. Whereas the old Sweetwater was really Jeannie Patterson and really almost like a one-man operation. She had a great team working with her, of course, mm-hmm. Dixie and John J.B. and all those people that worked there. But, yeah.
Okay.
So it's great. The good community, it's still a great community. There's too many traffic lights. What else? The traffic is a constant problem with everybody nowadays. And people are still, and everybody's still, there's a lot of people in sort of more in a rush than there used to be. Mm-hmm. Used to be a calmer town. But still, it's a spectacularly beautiful place, and I'm certainly happy to be here.
Mm. Well, before we close up this interview, I have one last question for you. Is there something that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about in this interview? Any last thoughts, any last comments, anything we missed? Did we get it?
I think we got it all. And if not, call me up. Bye.
Thank you so much for giving us your time and your story.
Thank you,
particularly
Debra.
Enjoyed the brawl in the old mill.
Play I know you the like brawl. The brawl in the old mill. You like the old mill school story.
Yeah. But just, I think we can, with a concluding thought, it would be play through the brawl. Stay calm, bring the sound down.
Keep calm and carry on. Yes, indeed.
A good motto to live your life by.
Lovely.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you at the Sweetwater, and we'll see you at the Throckmorton, and we'll see you around town.
Great.